Close your eyes for a second, and just picture the American Revolution.
Oh, I bet I know exactly what everyone is picturing right now.
Right. What is the very first default mental image that pops into your head? If you're like most of us, it is probably something incredibly specific.
Like a painting, almost.
Exactly, like George Washington standing heroically on a boat, crossing the Delaware. Or maybe you see these rigid, perfectly straight lines of men in red and blue coats,
Standing in a grassy field, yeah.
firing muskets through a thick haze of gray smoke. It is a very structured, very military, and frankly, very male image.
And that is exactly the textbook version of the war we have all been taught. It's a narrative that focuses almost entirely on troop movements, generals signing parchment, and the grand strategy of two armies clashing on an open field.
Right.
But the reality is, when you strip away the polished oil paintings and actually look at the accounts of the people living through it, you realize this wasn't just a structured military campaign.
No, not at all.
It was an incredibly messy, chaotic civil war. And that chaos didn't politely stop at the edge of a battlefield. It bled directly onto front porches, it crashed through parlor windows, and it literally tore through kitchens.
Which brings us to our mission for today's deep dive. We are going to completely dismantle the myth of the passive colonial woman.
Yes, we really need to.
We are looking at women who didn't just sit by the fireplace darning socks, waiting for the men to come home. To do this, we are pulling from a remarkable set of sources. It's called a My Patriot Story, Volumes 1 and 2.
Which is such a fantastic collection.
It really is. It was compiled by the Blue Ridge chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution, or the DAR.
And these volumes, they are a vital historical corrective. What you find in these pages is this rich, textured mix of black and white court records intertwined with family lore passed down through
This is
generations.
the real stuff.
Exactly. They give us the friction of everyday survival.
Okay, let's unpack this because standard history books give us the dates, the treaties, the macroscopic view.
The big picture, yeah.
But these archives give us the actual mechanics of how a society endures a war. Today, we're tracing a specific through line. We're going to examine how women fought back against the British, and honestly, sometimes against the suffocating legal framework of their own society.
Oh, definitely their own society.
Yeah, using the legal system, financial engineering, unimaginable physical endurance, and sheer psychological quick thinking.
Exactly. And to understand the magnitude of what they accomplished, we really have to start by looking at the legal
Oh,
battlefield.
for sure.
Because the chaos of the Civil War didn't just tear families apart physically, it completely ripped apart their legal standing.
Right. And you cannot understand the era without understanding the mechanism of coverture.
Yeah, coverture is key here.
Under English common law, which the colonies inherited, a married woman effectively suffered civil death.
Which is such a brutal phrase, civil death.
It is. The moment she said, "I do," her legal identity was entirely absorbed by her husband. She was covered by him. She couldn't own property in her own name. She couldn't sign contracts, sue or be sued. She had zero independent political or legal voice.
It is a profound vulnerability. I mean, you exist as a person, obviously, but on paper, you are a ghost. Your survival is entirely tethered to the decisions of the man who covers you.
Which brings us to Mercy Travis Raymond Bedford.
Yes.
So Mercy marries Jonas Bedford in 1755. They settle in North Carolina, they build a life, and they have 11 kids.
11 kids, just wow.
Right. For a couple of decades, it is just a standard, grueling colonial existence.
No.
But then the revolution breaks out, and Jonas makes a catastrophic decision.
He picks the wrong side.
He does. He doesn't just quietly side with the British either. He becomes a captain in the Loyalist militia. He actually fights against the Patriots at the notoriously brutal Battle of Kings Mountain.
And this is where the geopolitical reality just crashes into Mercy's domestic life. Because the tide of the war in the South eventually turns. By 1784, Jonas realizes he is on the losing side, and, well, to avoid the hangman's noose, he flees to England. But he leaves Mercy and their 11 children completely behind.
He just bails. And this is where the mechanics of Revolutionary War financing really come into play.
Yeah, people don't think about how this was paid for.
Exactly. Patriot militias and local governments were often completely broke. So how did they fund themselves? They confiscated loyalist estates. It
Yep.
was standard practice. You fight for the king, you forfeit your land to the state. Because Jonas is a traitor, Patriot forces seize his property.
The whole thing.
In 1781, Mercy and her 11 children are evicted. They're left entirely homeless.
And not because of anything Mercy did.
Exactly. but because of the legal structure of coverture.
Yeah.
Her husband's treason was legally her treason. It's like a legal black hole.
What's fascinating here is how Mercy responds. She doesn't just accept destitution, which a lot of people would have.
She really fights back.
She launches a highly sophisticated counterattack using the very legal system designed to erase her. She petitions the North Carolina General Assembly.
Which is bold.
So bold. And her argument isn't just, you know, an emotional plea for mercy. It is a surgical legal argument. She effectively demands that they suspend the law of coverture just for her.
I love this part. She tells a room full of male legislators who just fought a war to build a new government. She says, "My political identity is separate from his."
Right.
She argues that while her husband was a traitor, she was not. And she brings receipts.
She really does.
She proves that she and her son actively aided Patriot forces during the war, supplying them and offering shelter. She actually gets her neighbors, people who just spent years fighting against loyalist militias, like the one her husband commanded, to formally vouch for her loyalty.
It is a staggering request. She is forcing the newly formed state government to recognize her as an independent political entity.
Completely severing her legal existence from her husband's.
Yes. And on December 29th, 1785, the assembly agrees. They return the estate entirely to her.
But, and I have to push back a little here on how this story is traditionally framed.
Oh, the twist ending.
Yes, the twist ending that drives me crazy. Because 7 years later, Jonas, the loyalist traitor who abandoned his family, just waltzes back from England.
He really does.
And not only is he allowed back into the home Mercy fought tooth and nail to save, but he eventually becomes a magistrate. So I have to ask you, is this really a victory?
It's a tough pill to swallow for sure.
I mean, is it really a happy ending if the man whose treason almost destroyed the family gets to just step right back into a position of power and authority?
It's a completely valid frustration, and frankly, it highlights the deeply compromised nature of the society they lived in. Was it a perfect feminist triumph? No.
Not at all.
The patriarchy basically reasserted itself the moment Jonas stepped off the boat, but we have to measure Mercy's victory by the tools she had available at the time.
That's fair.
She navigated a completely rigged system and forced it to yield. Whether Jonas returned or not, he only had a home to return to, and those 11 children only survived because Mercy held the line and weaponized the law when he abandoned them.
That makes sense. It's a pragmatic victory, even if it's deeply unsatisfying to a modern sensibility.
Exactly.
But Mercy's story is about using the law to pull her family out of the rubble after the trauma. What happens when a woman understands the danger of coverture beforehand and tries to use the law as a shield to prevent the trauma from ever happening?
Right. And that takes us from the courtrooms of North Carolina to the brutal reality of the frontier and the story of Frances Madison Beale Hite.
Frances was a woman of significant standing. I mean, she was an aunt to the future President James Madison.
A very prominent family.
Yes. And before she married her second husband, Jacob Hite, she executed a piece of financial engineering that is honestly breathtaking. For the 1770s.
It really is ahead of its time.
She knew exactly how coverture worked. She knew Jacob would legally control all her assets the second they married. So she utilized the equity courts to create a legal trust.
Yep, a trust.
She placed 1,000 acres of her own land into this trust, managed by a third party, specifically to build a firewall around the inheritance of her son from her first marriage, Tavener Beale.
That's a brilliant maneuver. Equity law was one of very few loopholes wealthy women could exploit to maintain some semblance of financial control. She essentially drafted an 18th century prenuptial agreement.
Exactly. Her foresight is just incredible. Yeah. But the tragic irony of Frances's story is that while she successfully outsmarted the legal system, she could not outsmart the geography of the war.
No, she couldn't.
The Hite family moved to a trading post in Cherokee Territory in South Carolina. And the law means absolutely nothing when the violence of the frontier arrives at your front door.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Frances's story completely shatters the myth of the gentlemanly war. The frontier war was fundamentally different from the battles fought in places like Boston or Yorktown. It was intimate, gruesome guerrilla warfare.
It was messy.
Very. The British military strategy in the South heavily relied on recruiting Native American tribes to attack Patriot settlements, creating a terrifying second front.
And it was deeply personal. Mm. The Hites had a neighbor, a staunch loyalist named Richard Paris.
Oh, this guy.
Yeah, Paris didn't just disagree with Jacob Hite's politics. He literally weaponized the local geopolitical instability. Mm. Paris actively stoked tensions, turning the local Cherokee population against the Patriot-leaning Hides.
And that weaponized resentment just exploded. On July 1st, 1776, literally days before the Declaration of Independence is signed in Philadelphia, a massacre occurs at the Hyde Trading Post.
It's just horrific.
It is. Jacob Hyde is killed and his body is burned. Frances and her daughters are taken captive and dragged deep into the wilderness.
The accounts from the Patriot soldiers who tried to track them are horrifying. These men reported that as they closed in on the captors' camp, they could hear Frances screaming from a mountaintop.
Just chilling.
By the time they finally reached her, she had been tortured to death. It is a completely brutal, senseless end.
It is deeply disturbing. It forces us to confront the fact that women were not just accidental collateral damage in this war. They were active, deliberate targets.
The domestic sphere was violently invaded.
Exactly. Now, her legacy didn't completely end on that mountain. Her surviving son, George, who fought in the Continental Army and actually lost an arm in combat, later used the agonizing details of his mother's death, alongside his father's patriotism, to successfully petition the government to reclaim their stolen land.
It's such a heavy inheritance. Frances built a legal fortress to protect her family, but the sheer lawlessness of the frontier tore it down.
Yeah, the law can only do so much.
Which raises a really compelling question. What happens when the legal system is completely useless? When you can't rely on petitions or trusts, and you're forced to rely purely on your own physical body to save your family?
That brings us to our third narrative, which pivots from legal strategy to pure, unimaginable physical endurance. We are looking at the story of Karen Happoch Norman Turner.
To really grasp what Karen accomplished, you honestly only need to know one specific detail.
Her birth year.
The year she was born. 1690.
1690.
Now, fast forward to 1781. Karen is living in Maryland. She gets word that her son has been severely wounded fighting down south at the Battle of Guilford Courthouse in North Carolina. Doing the math, she is in her early 90s.
Which, by 18th century standards, is a statistical marvel. I mean, for a woman in her 90s to survive the standard diseases and harsh conditions of the era was incredibly rare.
Almost unheard of.
Most people that age were largely confined to their homes, relying on extended family for daily care.
But Karen doesn't stay home. She mounts a horse and rides hundreds of miles south.
On horseback.
Yes. Now, I don't want to just gloss over that ride. Think about the physical mechanics of what she is doing. She isn't taking a paved highway.
No, not at all.
She is riding on muddy, rutted wagon tracks that are effectively swamps when it rains. She is managing a massive caloric deficit. She is sleeping rough or in makeshift taverns.
Just grueling.
And she is riding straight into an active combat zone, navigating terrain, crawling with desperate deserters, highwaymen, and two warring armies at 90 years old.
It defies belief. But the ride was only the first phase of her endurance, because when she finally reached the gruesome aftermath of the Guilford Courthouse battlefield, she didn't just sit by her son's cot holding his hand.
No, she didn't.
She immediately went to work as his nurse.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we need to completely strip away the romanticized Florence Nightingale image of nursing.
Oh, absolutely.
What did battlefield medicine actually look like in 1781?
It was essentially a butcher shop. It was grueling, horrific physical labor. Musket balls didn't cleanly pierce the body, you know. They were heavy lead spheres that shattered bone and dragged filthy clothing deep into the tissue.
Oh, God.
Yeah, nursing meant manually cleaning out those infected cavities. It meant constantly fighting back gangrene, amputations happening without anesthesia, and managing raging fevers and dysentery without a single antibiotic or modern painkiller.
The smell alone.
The smell, the screams, the biological hazards, it was an absolute nightmare.
And Karen Happoch navigates all of it. A 90-year-old mother rode through a war zone, walked into a medical nightmare, and through sheer physical grit, she saves her son's life.
She actually pulls it off.
He survives. Her endurance was so undeniable that today she has a monument at the Guilford Courthouse National Military Park.
Yeah.
And it is recognized as the very first monument dedicated to a revolutionary heroine.
Her monument actually gives us a vital opportunity to redefine a historical term you hear quite often camp followers.
Oh, right. That term.
Yeah. In modern times, that term has developed a bizarre, almost entirely negative stigma, implying women who are just, you know, lingering around armies for unsavory reasons.
Right. Like a burden on the troops.
But historically, these women were the absolute vital logistics engine of a Continental Army.
They were the supply chain.
Precisely. They were the nurses, the cooks, the laundresses. George Washington's army was constantly teetering on the edge of collapse, and not always from British bayonets, but from typhus, dysentery, and starvation.
The unseen killers.
Exactly. Without the physical labor of these women managing the domestic survival of the camps, the troops would have completely dissolved. Karen Happeck represents the ultimate extreme example of that domestic power mobilized for war.
So we've traced an incredible arc here. We've seen Mercy Bedford use the law to fight the state. We've seen Frances Hite use complex trusts to secure wealth against coverture. We've seen Karen Happeck use a pure, grinding physical endurance to pull her son back from the brink of death.
It's an amazing spectrum.
It really is.
Yes.
For our final story, we transition to a totally different kind of resistance. What happens when you don't have time to write a petition and you don't have the luxury of a 100-mile ride?
Yeah, what then?
What happens when you have exactly 30 seconds to save your family?
We are talking about split-second psychological quick thinking under extreme, terrifying pressure. And for this, we actually have to move forward slightly in the timeline to 1798.
Right, because the end of the Revolutionary War didn't mean the end of British hostility.
Exactly. The context here is crucial. The British Navy was actively practicing a policy called impressment. The British Empire was constantly at war, and their Navy was bleeding manpower.
They needed bodies.
They did. To solve this, they engaged in what was essentially the legalized kidnapping of men, very often Irish emigrants crossing the Atlantic.
Which is terrifying.
Completely. British warships would intercept merchant or passenger vessels, board them, and forcibly draft men into naval service against their will. It was a terrifying reality of transatlantic travel.
Which brings us to teenage Frances Hoon. Frances and her family are emigrating from Ireland to America in 1798. They're out on the open ocean, incredibly vulnerable, when a British warship intercepts their vessel.
Nowhere to run.
Exactly. Heavily armed British officers storm the deck. Right in front of Frances, they grab her brother, physically overpower him, and drag him away to impress him into the Navy.
Awful.
She just lost her brother in the blink of an eye. And then the officers turn around and they start looking for her father.
The stakes are absolute. I mean, she is watching her family be dismantled in real time, and she knows her father is next.
She has only seconds to act. What does she do? She grabs her dad and physically shoves him inside a massive wooden storage cask sitting on the deck.
Just a big barrel.
Yeah, but the cask is obvious. Any officer doing a cursory sweep of the ship is going to look inside it. So Frances climbs up, sits squarely on top of the cask, and takes her heavy, cumbersome 18th century skirt, spreading the fabric completely out so it drapes over the entire structure.
And then she just sits perfectly still.
She turns herself into a statue. She plays the ultimate high-stakes game of chicken with the British Empire.
The nerve that must take.
Right. Officers are storming the deck, tearing the ship's hold apart, shouting, interrogating passengers, looking everywhere for her father. Imagine the adrenaline coursing through her body.
Heart pounding.
If she trembles, if she looks down, if she breathes too heavily, they will realize what she is sitting on. But she holds her nerve.
This raises an important question about how we fundamentally define agency in historical narratives.
How so?
Well, we are so conditioned to think of agency as charging a hill with a weapon or delivering a fiery speech in a courthouse. But Frances Hoon's story proves that sometimes survival and resistance are about pure stoic improvisation.
She weaponized the restrictive, heavy fashion that society forced upon women of her day, and she turned it into a literal shield to outsmart an empire. And she wins.
She really does.
The British eventually give up the search and leave the ship without her father.
It's a masterclass in psychological warfare, using exactly what you have in the exact moment you have it to bend reality to your will.
So when we synthesize all of this, when we put Mercy Bedford's brilliant legal warfare, Frances Hite's tragic financial foresight, Karen Happeck's grueling logistical grit, and Frances Hoon's split-second improvisation side by side, it fundamentally has to change how you view the patriot archetype.
Absolutely. The definition has been too narrow for too long.
Way too narrow.
A patriot isn't just a soldier in a uniform carrying a musket. A patriot is a mother navigating hostile courtrooms to protect her lineage. It's a grandmother riding into a camp of dying men to fight off infection. It's a teenager staring down naval officers from the top of a barrel.
Beautifully put.
For all of these women, the domestic sphere wasn't some quiet retreat entirely separate from the war. The domestic sphere was the battlefield.
So what does this all mean? Why does it matter that we shift our perspective and dig into archives like the Dadars My Patriot story?
It matters because of a sobering reality of historical research, which is the silence of the archives. We only know about Mercy, Frances Hite, Karen Happick, and Frances Hoon because someone, thankfully, took the time and resources to write their actions down and preserve the documents.
We're lucky to have them.
We are. But as you listen to this, you have to wonder how many women submitted brilliant legal petitions that were just thrown in the fire. How many grueling 100-mile rides were taken that didn't result in a stone monument.
Or how many acts of terrifying quick thinking went completely unrecorded because the women simply survived and moved on.
Exactly.
I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over. If our traditional telling of history focuses almost exclusively on the generals making grand strategies and the men holding the muskets, are we unintentionally robbing ourselves of the most vital survival lessons?
It's a great question.
By ignoring the legal maneuvering, the logistical endurance, and the psychological improvisation of these women, we might be studying exactly how wars are fought, while completely missing the lessons on how a society actually survives them. So the next time you close your eyes to picture the revolution, don't just look for the smoke on the battlefield. Look closer at the front porch. Stay curious.